I am delighted today to be speaking with Kevin Fidarco. He's an author and former Outside Magazine editor. His first book is called The Emerald Mile, and it details the story of the fastest descent of the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon in an open dory in 1983. He will be reading from his book as part of the May lecture series for Amigos Bravos on Water Matters tomorrow, May 20th, at the Santa Fe Community Foundation, beginning at 5:30 p.m. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Kevin.
Thank you, Zaylee. It's so nice to be here.
Well, it's very nice to have you, also a former Santa Fe resident. The Emerald Mile, we say, the book jacket and the online description say that the book is about this fastest descent of the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon. But that actual descent is a small part of the book. There are so many different aspects of it. Can you tell us what this book is about in your own words?
That's a good question. It's something that's not all that easy for me to address myself to, because I think in some ways, maybe the most accurate thing to say about it is that the storyline at the center of the book, this idea of a narrative of a record-setting fastest run ever through the Grand Canyon, that's really just kind of an excuse, if you will, to write what amounts really to a 430-odd page love letter to this very kind of secret and hidden world at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. It's a world of white water, and in the case of a few of the characters that I write about in this book, of wooden dories. And the subculture that arose out of and grew around those two passions, as they expressed themselves through a small group of people who became so incorrigibly infatuated with that world at the bottom of the Grand Canyon that they ultimately came to consider it their true home and develop a connection to it that whose strength, I think, exceeded perhaps anything else in their lives.
Can you describe for our listeners what a wooden dory is, for people who don't know the difference of different boats that go down Grand Canyon?
Yeah, so a dory is a particular kind of boat. It has a rather complex history, and like many other aspects of boat building, there's a lot of contention surrounding it, but one school of thought holds that this particular style of boat, the design arose right here in America off the coast of New England during the early part of the 19th century, the latter part of the 18th century. And those boats were originally used in the waters of the North Atlantic as part of the Grand Banks cod fishery, which was a big scene in the New England boating industry in the 19th century. And then the design made its way all the way across the country and achieved a different kind of expression along two very, very beautiful rivers in Oregon, the Mackenzie and the Rogue Rivers. By the 1920s, these little boats, which are characterized more than anything else by a flat bottom and by what we call rocker, which is to say a curve that begins at the bow and extends all the way to the stern, and a very high bow. These boats were being used on the Mackenzie and the Rogue as fly fishing vessels to convey celebrities at the time. We're talking about people like Herbert Hoover, Ginger Rogers. And so these were sort of delicate watercraft that were used to enable these people to go fly fishing on these rivers. And then it was not until the 1960s that they were discovered by a man in the Grand Canyon who was a big part of the Grand Canyon rowing scene during the 1950s and 1960s. His name was Martin Lydon. And it was he, really, who undertook what was at the time a rather harebrained idea, which was that you could take these delicate little fishing vessels, fly fishing vessels, which had open decks, and if you modified them in certain ways, they might be able to handle the savage hydraulics that prevail inside the rapids of the Grand Canyon. And it was that idea that really fueled the notion that became the heart of this little company that Lytton later built, and which emerged as really the only company ever to guide the bottom of the Grand Canyon, the whitewater there, exclusively in wooden dories.
Now, you mentioned Martin Lytton, and there are so many characters throughout this book that also represent the history of the Southwest, the history of conservation, and Martin Lytton is certainly one of those characters. Can you describe a little bit more about his role specifically and some of the others. There's John Wesley Powell. I love your description of another description of him as described as a stick of beef jerky adorned with whiskers. And your descriptions are beautiful and hysterical and entertaining throughout. And yet these characters are vastly important, again, not just for boating, I think, and not just for this culture, but really the way it's impacted the Southwest. Can you go through some of these people?
Sure. And maybe it's a good idea just to say that I think one thing that all of the characters at the center of this particular story hold in common is the idea that they all emerge on the page as kind of larger than life. And in a way, that's not surprising because they're really a reflection of some of the larger than life qualities that are I think part of the essence of and define the canyon itself. And so, you know, it's a nice piece of symmetry that the landscape and the human dynamics mirror one another in terms of some of the most fundamental characteristics. And so you mentioned John Wesley Powell, who probably looms as the largest figure. Every Grand Canyon River story really begins with John Wesley Powell. We're talking here about a man who was a major in the Civil War, and within the first few hours of the Battle of Shiloh, he was in charge of a battery of Union cannon, and he was raising his right arm to signal his gunners to fire when a Confederate mini-ball literally drove from his wrist down the length of his forearm. That forearm was amputated later the next morning, and yet Powell went on to serve in a number of other important battles during the Civil War. And then a few years after the Civil War, now we're talking the summer of 1869, this one-armed Civil War veteran led a party of 9 other men in 4 wooden boats, not dories, a different kind of boat, but part of the wooden boat rowing tradition in the Grand Canyon, on what was one of the greatest and most seminal journeys in the history of American exploration. The first recorded journey that we have down the length of the Green and the Colorado Rivers, and through a whole series of canyons that both of those rivers have carved, culminating in the first river trip that we know of through the Grand Canyon itself. This was a journey that really closed the door on the story of American exploration that had begun more than 60 years earlier with Lewis and Clark, and it ended with John Wesley Powell. And that story, there's really no better river story inside the Grand Canyon than the story of John Wesley Powell. But the interesting thing is that, you know, we mentioned a moment ago this other gentleman by the name of Martin Litton. And Martin Litton, if you hold up the photographs of both of these two men, they're bearded, gruff, scowling men. They clearly commanded a formidable presence. And you begin to realize that in some important ways, it's not inaccurate to say that Martin Litton really kind of represents a modern-day version of, if not incarnation, of John Wesley Powell. So Martin Litton, a veteran like John Wesley Powell himself, a glider pilot from the Second World War, grew up in just outside of Los Angeles, and was part of a team of pilots who were responsible basically for loading up gliders with men and machine guns and ammunition and gasoline and crash landing those aircraft behind enemy lines across France, Holland, and in the case of the last mission that Litton volunteered for, which was on Christmas Eve of 1945, Litton and about 100 other pilots flew medical supplies and gasoline, crash landing their planes inside the American perimeter, a little place called Bastogne, a village that had been surrounded by a massive German counterattack we now know as the Battle of the Bulge. And so I go into some detail about that because that offers you a little bit of a glimpse into the kind of character of this man and the ferocity and the determination that he then brought when he came back from the battlefields of Europe, that he brought to what he saw as the battlefields of American conservation. From his return to California, he flung himself into a whole series of what we now recognize as landmark environmental battles, first in California and then extending east to the Colorado River. And Lytton played a fairly major role in a series of seminal fights along the Colorado River involving the efforts to stop a whole series of dams that the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation was building along the Colorado. He was working with a man named David Brower, who at the time was the executive director of an organization called the Sierra Club. And the Sierra Club's efforts to prevent a series of dams going in directly into the Grand Canyon itself was a really watershed moment in the history of American conservation. Very few people, including myself, when I started this book, one of the things I didn't understand was that the Grand Canyon, right, Grand Canyon is a 277-mile stretch of the Colorado River running across northern Arizona. But that stretch of river, which is seen by so many Americans as being synonymous with the idea of wilderness, is buttressed between and bookended by two of the largest machines that we've ever built. The Hoover Dam at the downstream end with its giant reservoir called Lake Mead, and then at the upstream end, just 15 miles upstream from the entrance to the Grand Canyon, a dam that we call Glen Canyon Dam and its reservoir, Lake Powell. What a lot of people also don't realize, and I myself knew nothing about this when I started this project, was that the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation during the 1960s, their vision for the Grand Canyon itself was to supplement those two giant hydroelectric dams with two more dams, equally large, inside the Grand Canyon. And had those dams gone in, what we now know of and experience as the sort of marvelous, wild, pristine environment at the bottom of the canyon, that river would have been transformed into a stair-stepped series of stagnant reservoirs that today would undoubtedly be filled with houseboats and jet skiers. And so the fight and ultimately the victory in preventing those dams from going in represented a sort of coming-of-age moment for the American conservation movement, which up to that point was really just seen as a rather kind of indulgence, self-indulgence kind of movement on the part of, they were called posy pickers at the time. And they really emerged from that fight with political clout. They were able to demonstrate that they could go up against one of the most powerful arms of the United States government and stop it cold in its tracks. Martin Lytton was a huge part of that fight. His Dories were a huge part of that fight. But what makes him loom so large in the Grand Canyon is that that's only part of his story down there. But that gives you a little bit of an idea of who the man was and the role that he played in the stories there.
And I'm sure the listeners can tell from your descriptions here that it is that much and more in the book. I mean, you not only create this incredible landscape of history of the Southwest, but you also convey these stories down the river with John Wesley Powell, Martin Lytton, and then later Kenton Grua, who is the one who did the fastest descent. It is exciting, it's fast-paced, it is like this incredible adventure, but you have these extraordinary details, again, about the history. And I feel like I've read a lot of books about the Southwest, but this is conveyed in such a wonderful manner. I would really recommend people who are interested in the Southwest to pick this up completely, as well as the exciting world of river rafting that really comes through, and this kind of subculture, which is interesting. You talk so much about stories. There is their own history that kind of comes through in these stories, mythic to the most banal, and it's incredibly entertaining to hear. But I love these characters. You talk a lot about the dams. You talk a lot about Glen Canyon Dam. There's a big part of this that talks about even a, though the Bureau may not admit it may have been a possible breach in the dam, there was definitely something that happened in 1983. Will you describe the conditions in 1983?
Yeah, so if you talk to river guides and weather experts, they will both tell you the same thing, that 1983 was a year like no other. If you speak to meteorologists, the first thing they'll tell you about 1983 is that 1983 was the year that we saw the largest El Nino event on record up to that point. Now, since then, we've seen even larger El Ninos. Many people experts feel that some of those are driven or influenced by climate change. But 83 represented a kind of important juncture point in meteorology. The story of how that those weather patterns developed is complex and probably not worth going into here, but suffice it to say that we're talking about a series of meteorologic anomalies that were triggered late in 1982 on the far end of the Western Pacific Ocean, and over the next 6 months began making their way across the Pacific and then manifesting here in the United States in the form of a series of what were called at the time superstorms. It began smashing into the coast of California, starting in Christmas and running through New Year's and much of January of that year, dumping enormous amounts of rainfall into the coastal regions of California. And then as they started slamming into the California Sierras, smashing every standing snowfall record that we had. And the thing about it was that those storms, often those storms are wrung, the moisture in a lot of storms tend to get wrung out by the Sierra, but those storms were laden with so much moisture in 83 that they just continued lumbering east, filling up the Great Basin, arroyos and dry lake beds with water, and then slamming into our part of the world, the Southern Rockies. The snowpack that year was not the largest snowpack that we've ever seen. What made it really unique, however, was that the temperatures held very low until very, very late in the spring. And then on May 28th, the temperatures suddenly shot up into the high 80s, and you have an entire snowpack coming down out of the Rockies in one vast, huge, wet, uncontrollable rush. Filled up every stream and artery and tributary of the main stem Colorado and the Green Rivers in the upper Colorado River Basin. And all of that water was headed directly to one place, which was the upper tentacles of Lake Powell, this giant reservoir that backs up behind the Glen Canyon Dam. Hard to overstate the size of that reservoir. It's a reservoir that's 186 miles long. That's the longest reservoir in the continental United States. When it reaches full pull, we're talking about 9 trillion gallons of water. And so that water, all of that water arriving unexpectedly and virtually at once, created a crisis that really had no precedent in the history of American hydroelectric engineering. And the story of that crisis really begins with one simple fact, which is that by the end of May and the first couple of days of June, the engineers and the managers of the Glen Canyon Dam, and we're talking now, mind you, about a wall, a 500-foot wall of concrete that stands athwart the Colorado River. The surface of Lake Powell was climbing, clawing its way up the upstream face of that structure at a rate twice as fast as those engineers were capable of releasing water around and through the dam. And so the first real problem they confronted was that if they did not find a way of addressing that problem, the surface of the lake was ultimately going to breach the parapet of the dam, thereby creating a 500-foot waterfall down the face of the dam and taking out the power plant at the bottom. So there, in a nutshell, you have the start of what unfolded as a very, very complex engineering problem. And the story of this beleaguered team of engineers and the resilience and the ingenuity that they had to draw on to confront this, the first of a series of domino problems, because each problem was exacerbated by the one that came before it. The story of how they confronted and ultimately solved that is a big part of this book. But the most salient fact to keep in mind is that part of the solution was to get as much of Lake Powell around and through the dam as they possibly could. Once they did that, they weren't too concerned about what was happening to the water. But what they were doing was creating a giant artificial flood inside the Grand Canyon. Keep in mind that the Colorado River, during the 20 years prior to this event, the flow of that river had usually oscillated between 7,000 cubic feet per second and at most 30,000 cubic feet per second. And by the third week in June of 1983, the managers at the Glen Canyon Dam were sending 93,000 cubic feet per second of water into the Grand Canyon. They're fire hosing this water into the canyon, And there are more than two dozen commercial expeditions. We're talking a couple hundred boats and passengers inside this 277-mile corridor of rock. There's no way to get out. And successive surges are coming down on top of them as the managers are ramping up their discharges around and through the dam. And this is creating a series of very, very dramatic events as the river, some of the rapids are washing out, but at a few distinctive choke points, things are going absolutely haywire. And all of this, the crisis at the dam, and the series of dramatic events that are unfolding on the river creates, in the mind of one man, this man that you mentioned a few moments ago, a river guide by the name of Kenton Grua, an employee of Martin Litton's, and in some ways someone who seems to represent a kind of incarnation, if you will, of John Wesley Powell, at least John Wesley Powell's pioneering spirit. He came up with an idea that what everybody else was seeing as a tragedy and a crisis was an opportunity, and that if the idea was rather simple, that if he took this little dory, his dory called the Emerald Mile, and placed it illegally into the river, if he convinced two men, two of his friends who were also river guides, to come along with him, if they brought along a car battery with a set of jumper cables hooked up to a spotlight, if they launched an hour before midnight, timed to the full moon, so that they could supplement the illumination from the spotlight with the light of the moon, if they did all those things, and then they started rowing at the crest of this flood, and if they kept rowing without stopping, each man rowing as hard as he possibly could for 20 to 25 minutes until he could barely pull his fingers off the oar locks, and if those three men rotated around the decks of that little wooden boat ceaselessly, day and night, not stopping for anything, not stopping to scout, not stopping to assess any of the whitewater, not stopping if any of the rangers who were patrolling the river told them that they had to pull over. If they kept at this, the idea was that it might be possible to take the standing speed record for the fastest boat ever through the Grand Canyon and not only break that record, but smash it so decisively by virtue of using an artificial flood as a hydraulic catapult, sending them through the canyon, that they would they might be able to move from Lee's Ferry through the Grand to the Grand Wash Cliffs faster than any other boat in history and set the bar so high that nobody else would ever break it again. So that's the vision and the idea. And it's what propelled these three men down the river under these conditions and really set the narrative for the story at the heart of this book.
And it certainly takes a madman to do an amazing feat like this, completely mad. And you describe his kind of quote-unquote obtaining a permit to actually do this, which was a bit questionable and in the end denied. But the symbology of this, talk about that a little bit, because it wasn't just wanting to beat the fastest record. I mean, this was about having a free river, having a flood, what a river might be like at one point. Talk about that a little.
Well, Kenton Grua was in many ways a protege of Martin Litton, and like many of Martin Litton's guides, Grua absorbed Litton's ideas and his philosophy about conservation, about the ethics of stewardship when it comes to landscape features. A philosophy that I think perhaps was expressed most beautifully in Litton's tradition of naming his boats. The Emerald Mile may sound like an unusual name. It was part of a tradition that involved conferring on each of Litton's dories the name of a natural wonder that had been destroyed by the hand of man. And Litton's idea was that, and some of these boats were named after rivers, you know, the Skagit and Chattahoochee that have been dammed. Others were named after gorgeous features that were part of Glen Canyon, this marvelous and sublime canyon just above Grand Canyon, whose beauty was said to have transcended the beauty of the Grand Canyon itself, and which now lies beneath, submerged beneath the waters of Lake Powell. Many of the boats were named after features that are now underneath the waters of Lake Powell. And so these boats, which were painted in bright colors, whose lines are just gorgeous to look at. These boats were intended to be acts of admonishment and remembrance. They were meant to suggest to anyone who saw their names emblazoned on their bows that we had committed environmental sins for which atonement is not really fully possible because those places have been lost irrevocably. In any case, Grua absorbed all of this. And so part of what Grua saw happening, part of the way that he interpreted the events of 83, was he was sort of convinced that this artificial flood was really the result of a resurgence of the ancestral river, this river that had been straitjacketed by 19 major dams and rivers that had been turned, transformed and transmogrified from the greatest river in the Southwest into something that really more closely resembles a plumbing system, a river that enables, people to, giant metropolises like Phoenix, to rise out of the desert in places that they should never have been put in the first place, a river that whose waters enable people, the residents of Phoenix, to have swimming pools, the residents of Tucson to golf, and the visitors to Las Vegas to have their skies lit up at night by neon. All of those things are made possible by what has been done to the Colorado River. And so Grua saw the events of 1983 as a symbolic affirmation of the wrongness of all of that. And he was delighted by the manner in which the managers of the Glen Canyon Dam and the bureaucrats of the Bureau of Reclamation had been caught by surprise, and that their one of their landmark hydroelectric dams was now in peril. And so the journey that he was taking was not just to sort of get himself into the record books. Mm-hmm. It was really to participate in and merge with and communicate directly with the ancestral power of this river that he felt such a deep, visceral, personal connection to. It was a much larger journey that was unfolding in his own mind. And in the telling of that story, that is really what enables so many other elements to be folded in. And I think it's what makes this more than just simply an adventure story, more than just simply, a 5,000-word story that we might have put together back in the days when I was writing for Outside Magazine. It is that, but in my mind, and in Kent and Grua's mind, I think it became much, much more than that.
I've been speaking with Kevin Fedarko about his book, The Emerald Mile. He will be presenting part of the May lecture series for Amigos Bravos. He'll be speaking tomorrow, May 20th, at the Santa Fe Community Foundation. It's at 501 Helena. That begins at 5:30. Again, the book, The Emerald Mile, the epic story of the fastest ride in history through the heart of the Grand Canyon. It is a fantastic book. Kevin, you are an extremely, extremely talented writer, and it was such a joy to read this and to learn about the Southwest. You are also a river guide, has writing this book, going through the history, through the stories, changed the way you see the Grand Canyon when you now go through it?
It has, fundamentally, and I think I'm going to try and speak a little bit about that tomorrow night, at the lecture. But yeah, I mean, I stumbled upon this story as an apprentice river guide in the canyon, because one of the things that happens in the canyon is that you sit around at night around a campfire, if it's spring or the fall, and you listen to river guides tell stories. And so the telling of this story became part of the fabric of my own experience inside the Grand Canyon. And yes, the 10-year journey to kind of report and then lay the story out in the pages of the book, I think enriched my own understanding and deepened my own understanding of the river in a way that never would have been possible if I had just been a passive listener.
Well, thank you, Kevin, so much for being with us this morning. Again, tomorrow, 5:30 p.m. at the Santa Fe Community Foundation. Go hear Kevin, buy his book. It's a fantastic book. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you, Zaylee.